Take a network break, brush the crumbs from your virtual donut off your shirt, and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news, lightly salted with inspirational cynicism. The voice you're hearing in your head right now, it's me, Drew Conry Murray. Greg Farrow was the other voice, and if you're hearing a third, you might want to get that checked. Today's show is...
I've been accused of being schizophrenic, but all four of us can play that game. I'm here all week, trying the virtual donuts.
All right, today's show is sponsored in part by InterOptic. They offer high-performance, high-quality optics at a fraction of the cost. You can find out more at interoptic.com. And if you're heading to InterOp 2018 in Vegas, you can stop by the InterOptic booth to learn how they can help you spec the right optics for your network. Also, please stay tuned after the news to hear a sponsored conversation with Kentik about monitoring visibility and how to use network and business data for fun and packets. So, Greg, last week we talked a lot about open networking. That was kind of the theme of the show, and it seems like a theme developing this week might be edge computing.
Yeah, you think so. Remember, you know how I have this sort of broad theory about fashion?
Yes.
You know, black is so in this season. You know, like this year is colors and floaty things, and I think next spring we're going to be looking at cotton. It's just going to be cotton, and it's going to be draped straight down. And so now in enterprise IT, it's all about the edge computing. Got it?
Got it. Yeah, I mean, we've got some stories to kind of back up that fashion notion. First, Microsoft is pledging to invest $5 billion over the next 4 years on IoT and edge computing initiatives.
I don't think much of this. $5 billion sounds like a very big number, but big companies have habits of saying, you know, $5 billion, and then you go to find out where it went, and you don't. It was like, oh yeah, no, we're going to spend that over 10 years, so it's only $500 million a year, and we spent a bit in the first year, and then we got, and then that person left, and then we did nothing. So you know, right. color me unimpressed. It's like, remember when Cisco was going to spend $1 billion on Intercloud?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And by my best reckoning, I think they spent maybe 100, 150, maybe 200 million, but never actually spent the rest of the billion. So I'm a bit dubious about this. And the second thing is, 5 billion is actually nothing. It's a pittance. It needs to be something like 10 to 20 billion. In February 2016, Cisco went out and bought Jasper for 1.4 billion. It went out and bought AppDynamics for 3 billion, mm-hmm. right? Just mm-hmm. to pump up its IoT strategy. Mm-hmm. There's $5 billion right there. Right. Just in those acquisitions alone, and Microsoft's going to come out of the blocks. It's going to be like easily three or four years behind its competitors, and now it's going to invest $5 billion in IoT. This really doesn't say anything good for Microsoft. I think it's a complete fallacy to think that they're going to do anything here and move the needle.
So the announcement came via a corporate blog from the Azure division talking about investing in R&D around IoT and Edge, and it is, as corporate blogs go, pretty fluffy, pretty light on detail. It mm-hmm. seems to me kind of like a market signal, like we know people are interested in IoT and Edge, and we think we can take the products we have and kind of point them in that direction. So, hey, we promise all you investors, we're serious about it. Please don't hassle us.
Yeah, and I mean, I've said before that big companies often have big failures. They do big, stupid things. Just to give you an example of this in IoT, because all the big companies think they should own IoT. Mm-hmm. They think it's their privilege. Hark back to where we were with GE Digital, and GE Digital was starting up an IoT business unit called Predix.
That's right.
Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
And there's a link in the show notes about why GE didn't make it big with that product, why it completely failed. And really what it did was it just allocated all this money and then made the business unit be a profit center, right? So they mm-hmm. started off this IoT and they said, we're going to take over the whole IoT market in all the world. But then they said, but you can't make a loss. And so you have to make money. So
right
what
out of
did
the
they
gate.
Do? Right out of the gate, they have to make a profit. Mm-hmm. And they had these ambitious targets of like tens of billions of dollars worth of revenue in such blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. But the only way they could make money was to go into GE's business units and suddenly do IoT for them, because they were the only ones who could be forced into doing business with itself. And in the end, the business unit failed. And they lost billions of dollars on this so-called, you know, IoT strategy around Predix. And effectively, the only thing that's using it these days is a handful of GE business units who signed on early enough and got strong-armed into it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, just because Microsoft ponies up for edge computing to get into the latest fashion, you know, tie-dye T-shirts this season, beautiful, doesn't mean it's actually going to be a success. Let's wait and see. Let's see if there's some poop underneath the smell.
All right. I guess that's one way to put it. Well, sticking with this theme, at the website, the next platform.
Just before we go on, I should also point out that AWS has a whole IoT strategy here too.
Oh, I bet
and
they do.
And a far more competent one. You think about all of those Alexa voice things. That's IoT, right? And those little buttons that you get with AWS. And they've got a whole back end that you can go and rent on AWS. And there's a operating system that goes on edge devices that gives you the whole platform already. And Microsoft's got none of that.
Yeah, I'm sure they're looking at Amazon, who is very good at moving into business opportunities very fast, very quickly, and thinking, oh, crap.
Yeah, but I mean, to think about it, you know, Amazon not only has a whole database system and an engine, a whole IoT operational platform so that if you have devices littered around the edge, you've got a whole platform of communications thing. So you just turn the device, and they've got the operating system that you put on the edge device, and you've got all of the back-end stuff in the cloud that drives it. So if you want to write some code on top, so if you wanted to build, I don't know, some sort of door lock, a remote door lock system, all you have to do is go and sign up for AWS's IoT platform, get their operating system, and start producing the devices and getting them in the stores. That's it, done. Everything else is just code on Amazon's cloud.
Yep.
So, you know, where exactly does Microsoft plan to suddenly turn up in edge computing? It doesn't sound right to me.
Right. And I'm sure they would say, well, we have software to run on devices. We have Azure Cloud to do the processing. We have applications that can take advantage of it, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, they've got to put some wood behind the arrow, so to speak.
More than wood. They've got to put a whole bunch of process and code, and $5 billion isn't even remotely going to cut it. They're going to have to be, if they were talking $25 billion, I'd believe it.
All right. We'll color Greg skeptical. Okay, so moving on to this fashion theme, the website, The Next Platform, they've got a very detailed story about how Aruba Networks, which is owned by HPE, is kind of being used by HPE to lead the organization's efforts around IoT and edge networking.
So this is not a surprise. I think HPE is still struggling to get outside the data center. I think they're still focused on their servers since they got rid of all that software over to Micro Focus, which then, of course, is having a very bad time keeping that working. I do wonder if that's got some secondary effects, like maybe some of its trusted customers are walking back from HPE. I wonder if that's causing some secondary effects. But it makes sense for everything edge to be around Aruba. Aruba has a much greater understanding of customers, and wireless is a key part of any edge strategy, don't you think?
Certainly, you need that access, right? And IoT devices are going to connect wirelessly over the network. My wonder is, though, obviously, yes, the network, the connectivity is important. But when you're talking about particularly the edge computing, that's about compute, that's about storage, and that's about the software to do the analytics that you're supposed to derive the value from. And that to me does not seem like Aruba's forte.
Yeah. Wireless is like saying, I've got a sewage system, but I'm not too, but getting the contents of the sewage from one place to another is the game. Not owning the sewage system, right? Where's the analytics engine? Where's the IoT database platform? Where's device management? Where's the embedded software? Where's the hardware? Well, you know, true, HPE's got an edge line converged edge system, so maybe that's where they're getting it from.
Presumably, and HPE did move that edge line system under Aruba's into that unit. Okay. So obviously, that's where they're aligning it. But yeah, I feel like, obviously, Aruba's making investment in doing analytics around WLAN performance and user management stuff, which makes sense for a WLAN company, but that doesn't necessarily translate to the kind of deep business-driven analytics that you want to get out of analyzing all kinds of data, like sensor data and so on, that's not related to your wireless management. So I think this is another case where aspirational, we need to be at edge, we need to talk about IoT, and then you just give it to Aruba and see what they can do with it.
I need to have a little black dress in my lineup to make it complete. But I mean, the thing here is that you need, let's say you're building an edge appliance, an IoT edge appliance for a factory, and you've got a bunch of machines there. So sure, you might go to HP and buy their converged edge systems, x86 in a hardened box that you can put out there, and you need some Wi-Fi to connect it up. But what you really need is a cloud platform with a back end that can hold all that data. And I need an analytics system like, say, Amazon Redshift or Elasticsearch or Kinesis. And maybe I need some database. Maybe I need some DynamoDB or something like that. And then I need to have firewalls and security engines and internet gateways and all that stuff in the back end. Where's that?
Right.
Am I going to go to AWS and then get HP devices and run my own Linux and then code up everything that I... Or would I just go to Amazon and say, give me one of those boxes, I'll use that?
Yeah, and again, that makes me like, if I was HPE and thinking about who do I want to entrust with this, I might be thinking about my HCI, my hyperconverged division, because you're really going to need that integration of compute and software and storage in a friendly box.
So that's the other way of doing it, is saying my edge compute is actually going to be mini data centers.
Right,
so
exactly. Yep.
A one rack hardened box that goes into the edge of the factory, and then you have all the nodes around. But again, where's all the software to run all that?
Well, I should say in the article that I referenced, Next Platform, I'll have a link to it. They do also tout, we've got over 450 partners in our ecosystem. And so obviously HPE knows it can't do all the lifting itself. It's going to, you know, take advantage of relationships with software developers to build presumably application software. But again,
my point is it starts to become more of a mess. The biggest, but the unsolved part of IoT is the software that brings it all together.
Right.
When you collect this data, where does it go? Does it go off to the cloud, or do you process it locally and then upload it to the cloud?
Well, that's the point of edge computers. You do some local processing and then send it to your cloud backend,
Or is it is edge compute the actual IoT node that actually interfaces to the sensors?
It's not clear either, right?
Uh-huh. It could be, you know, a little Intel NUC-sized box with 50 sensors attached to, you know, machine such and such, with vibration data and RPMs and electrical, sensors and all that. And it could just be a NUC. It doesn't have to be some, you know, 48 RUs of servers and storage arrays. but, it, you know, that data does have to get back. So it does make sense for Aruba in terms of the wireless is the starting point. If they're thinking that the way that they can build out an IoT strategy is to start with the wireless, with their SDN controllers and access control and security, and sell it to the infrastructure people, well, okay. But let's just express some wisdom here and say that the bigger part of the IoT platform is what Cisco's got with Jasper and AppDynamics, where they're actually working with the developers to put code and inside of the devices to monitor the quality of the code, and Jasper, which gives you all of that database and stuff. And AWS has got this. Google hasn't got it yet. Azure hasn't got it yet. That's what we're sort of talking about, is two different ways, and there's some pretty big gaps between those approaches.
That's right. All right, one more story sort of tied to IoT and edge computing. Intel is selling Wind River. They make embedded software. It's being sold to a private equity firm, TPG Capital. If you remember, Intel acquired Wind River back in 2009 for $884 million, but they did not disclose how much they are shifting Wind River over to TPG for.
Which suggests not for much.
Maybe less than they bought it for, perhaps.
That would normally suggest that it's being sold for less than they bought it for, and they don't want to make a big deal out of that. So Wind River is fairly famous, fairly well known for making software that you don't know anything about. It has a thing called VxWorks, which is a real-time operating system that goes into a lot of embedded devices, and particularly things like cars. Quite a lot of cars run on VxWorks. If you remember back 10, 20 years ago, a lot of Cisco routers ran VxWorks underneath their apps. So the operating system back in the days of MIPS was actually a version of VxWorks and so forth. And they have their own software-defined infrastructure software. So a lot of people have been using VxWorks as appliances, and they have a cloud platform around the back of that. So it's, the idea for Intel buying it was it meant to be a deal maker in the mobile and embedded space. So what we're just talking about, it's an operating system that was meant to take them into the edge. But
the edge, and also
so
industrial systems, and of course, self-driving cars and automotive systems are going to be a big, a big deal for compute companies going forward as well.
Mm-hmm. And Intel's had a bit of a mixed history there. They haven't been able to get the power consumption down. They've tended to make their CPUs bigger and hotter and more expensive. And of course, the edge is the opposite of that. And ARM seems to have stolen a bit of an edge there, a bit of competitive space. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Intel's going to do something in here and come back around, but does that leave them with Wind River as a key part of that strategy? And I think the answer is obviously not. So there it shall go.
All right.
But keep in mind too, Intel isn't giving up on the edge. We saw 2 weeks ago at the Open Networking Foundation kick off a new project called the Acrino Edge Stacks. That's A-K-R-A-I-N-O, Acrino Edge. And that's meant to be a full software stack for building an edge node point. And that's being done under the auspices of the Linux Foundation. So I don't think, and it says here, driving alignment around high availability cloud services for the network edge. So, you know, Intel has committed to open source major components of its Wind River Titanium Cloud portfolio and Intel Network Edge Virtualization Software Development Kit. Acrino Edge Stack will offer users new levels of flexibility of scale edge cloud services quickly to maximize. So this is that operating system that sits at the edge of the cloud. So maybe Intel thinks that that's where it's going to be, is that rack of servers, and there's an operating system there to run that on-prem edge cloud type stuff.
And they've got the chip they want to sell you to run that operating system.
Yes, that's right. That would be a very quick summary of it. It'd be interesting to see how that project builds out over time.
All right, well, quick break to tell you about today's sponsor, Interoptic. Demand from the edge, 5G, and IoT, oh, there's that word again, are coming. If you're not doing optics correctly, you're going to pay for it later. Interoptic understands that you need more nimble layer zero, and they support a full range of products that you need today and don't yet know what you'll need tomorrow. You don't have to pay OEM prices for optics. You can start talking to optic experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers for a fraction of the price. And don't be fooled by lesser optics. The difference between generic third party and brand equivalent optics matters, so you can purchase the same, if not better performing optics at a fraction of the cost. And they're designed by engineers who truly understand what you need. It's time to take control of your optics purchases with Interoptic. So head on over to interoptic.com to get more details. And if you'll be at Interop 2018 in Vegas, you can head over to the Interoptic booth and they can help you spec out the right optics for your network. All right, back to the news. If you remember last week, we talked about AT&T's pledge to deploy 60,000 white box routers as part of their 5G rollout, and that was bad news for legacy vendors like Cisco. So I found an article in Motley Fool about Cisco and AT&T. And it says that AT&T spending on Cisco networking dropped from $4 billion back in 2013 to just $400 million in 2017. A little data point there.
Not surprising, really. We've known about that for a while. And I think that the carriers have been largely backing off their investments for some time, knowing that 5G is coming. Mm-hmm. And you know, they made massive investments in 3G, followed by a secondary massive investment in 4G. Mm-hmm. And it made sense to hold off on investments and to start putting that money, you know, into the balance sheet while you wait to see what 5G looks like. And so this is nothing surprising here in that sense. We've known that service provider business is shrinking quickly, but if you also look at Cisco's service provider business unit, it's changing very rapidly. Look at the success of their network services orchestrator. We saw iOS XR disaggregate recently. Mm-hmm. You know, get away. It's now ready to run on white boxes. So Cisco's not out of that game completely. And they're doing lots of other changes inside of it to make their hardware more attractive to the telcos. And the question is it enough? So when the carriers come around to refresh their hardware, we already know that Huawei's locked out, ZTE's locked out. So really, the only people who are going to get into the spend when the new rollout comes in, and it has to come at some point as these carriers move to upgrade, it has to be Cisco, Juniper, Ciena, you know, those types of companies. Then they have to be US-based because the US government regards its telco infrastructure as critical infrastructure and doesn't want to see it go to overseas makers.
Right.
So the data talks to me. It says, yes, we knew that, and you know, the money comes down, and there's lots of revenue that Cisco's getting out of AT&T in terms of maintenance revenue for keeping existing stuff going.
Sure.
You could be assured of that. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is that Cisco did receive a 2018 AT&T Supplier Award. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
And I quote from the Cisco press release, Cisco aligned themselves with AT&T's priorities and exceeded our expectations in helping provide for our customers, said Suzanne Johnston, Executive Vice President, Global Connections Management and Supply Chain. AT&T, she said, together we delivered smart solutions and exceeded customer expectations. Blah, 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 blah. Lots of, and then really degrades into blowhard speech at that point. But so while you might think to yourself, oh, that's terrible, you know, spending on Cisco network equipment has shrunk from $4 billion to $400 million. At the same time, AT&T is giving them awards for exceeding customer expectation. So make of that what you will.
Well, it's probably cheaper to give them an award than spend $2 billion. So.
Wonder how much the award's worth.
I'm sure it's a very nice, you know, one of those glass or sort of Perspex shiny
that's
awards
like when the
with
vendors
some engraving
ring us
on
up
it.
And say, that sounds like when the vendors ring us up and say, we'd love to give you some free exposure. It's like, just pay the bills.
Yeah. All right, some numbers from IDC around hyperconverged infrastructure. They released their Q4 2017 revenue numbers. Dell EMC is leading the pack with quarterly revenues of $346 million and a 27.8% market share. Nutanix is in second. They posted $243 million with revenue of 19.5% market share. And then HPE and Cisco are in a statistical tie for third place.
And the crowd goes, wow, Greg gets it right. HCI, think of the, I've been telling you for a while, haven't I?
Sure,
did you just pick that piece out just because that's what I said it was going to be? Or did you genuinely just think that was a good thing to talk about?
I like numbers. It's fun to see numbers.
Fun to see numbers. I think I've been saying for quite some time now that hyperconverged is where it's all going to go. And these numbers really tell that story. 69% growth for hyperconverged in total, according to IDC, tells the story, I think.
69% growth year over year is for the whole industry is pretty massive. That's a nice big and growing pie.
It's not a very big base, though, all right? So you're
well,
only
that's
talking...
true. You sort of started from not quite zero because it's been out for a couple of years. But yes, that's why I think that number's so big.
Yeah. So, you know, when you see numbers like HPE saw the biggest revenue growth at 340%, you're thinking to yourself,
whoa.
How much of it is just a repackaging of his existing? All of a sudden, we hit that with the HCI wand, and there you go. Boom. Hyperconverged revenue. And Cisco's doing well too. Although Cisco isn't doing so great. I did read some research saying that Cisco's hyperconverged strategy hasn't done so well. And I do wonder if Cisco's lack of focus here, that is, it doesn't sell its own. It has at least 10 partnerships with third parties for hyperconverged, like NetApp and Pure Storage and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And they all involve some Cisco networking and some Cisco UCS servers at some point, and then some software somewhere along the line. And it's got its own, and it's got, and that I wonder if that lack of focus means that Cisco's struggling to get the message out that it's actually a hyperconverged vendor. Like the days of partnerships might be coming to an end, perhaps, when the messaging and the marketing and the sales gets very messy.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, you can look at it both ways. Cisco could probably flip it and say, but we give the customer choice. If it's NetApp they prefer under the covers, we give that to them. If it's Pure they prefer under the covers, then we're using our, what was it, Simplivity that they acquired or Syncricity? Yeah. They acquired a storage software management layer to bolt the storage to their UCS
that
platform.
Gives them distributed storage, but they've also got equal, you know, NetApp SolidFire version. They've got a Pure Storage one. They've got, every storage vendor that's out there seems to partner with Cisco. The question is that actually hyperconverged or just converged?
Mm-hmm.
So remember VBlocks,
the
partnership between EMC and Cisco and VMware, and they were selling that as a converged system. And really, it wasn't actually all that converged, except you were restricted in what you could buy. So, you know, what's the difference between converged and hyperconverged, and how do you define that? So I think this would be a report to get into the details before you start to, you know, prognosticate too wildly.
Well, I have a link to at least the press release of the report. And IDC does break out converged versus hyperconverged, and they have a definition. You can look at it in the report and see for yourself. So according to IDC's version anyway, this is a hyperconverged versus a Cisco converged system. So
So when you talk about converged, the Cisco NetApp converged is 560 million, Dell Inc. 735 million. So that's the old VBlock business.
Right.
I would imagine that's shrinking away quite nicely. Yeah, look at that, minus 15% as people walk back from that and go in other directions away from EMC Dell. Yeah, more into hyperconversion. Then Dell, of course, has had 140% growth in hyperconversion, not quite offsetting the shrinkage in converge, but that's okay. They're probably happy enough with that. Nutanix, of course, is steady and growing quite nicely. So it's really going to come down to things like, you know, is this where these companies want to be? I suspect the answer is, you know, if you're going to have an edge, you want hyperconverged systems to put onto the edge because you want to build software that can be that edge.
Yep. All right, our last couple of stories for this episode, calling it Breachings in Brief. You know, barely a week goes by, we don't have some news of a breach or another coming to light. So up first, we've got Sears and Delta. They had some breaches, and they're pointing the blame at a partner for intrusions that expose card details for hundreds of thousands of customers. And this partner is 247.ai, that I guess they provide like online chat software for customer service and call centers.
Yeah.
Attackers found a way in through there and then exfiltrated data from Sears and Delta Airlines.
There's been a few of these this week. Apparently, I'd say some of the hackers have been looking at online chatbots and chat software in the customer call centers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually, not only are they able to steal information, so actually use that to pivot into insight through the defenses and then land and then move laterally to extract valuable data. They're also using it to identify the people in the call centers. So they're getting names, email addresses, phone numbers of the people. So they're actually using that and then using social engineering to call those people and get logins and stuff.
Uh-huh. So, okay, yeah, and probably some spear phishing going on, I would imagine. Yeah.
And quite honestly, all of that chat software drives me insane, right? So the idea that that stuff is insecure and it should all be taken off people's website makes me happy. Because
it's never being taken off the site, though. It's cost savings out the wazoo for these companies.
Well, so they say, so somebody says. I'm sure it's like, if only we had a call center, we'd be saving money. And how well that worked out.
Well, that's the thing. You don't have to hire as many actual humans when you've got some tedious AI bot irritating the customers.
I do suspect these over online chat apps are dreadfully insecure. The companies who run them are often local merchants, very dodgy operations, and you shouldn't be putting them on your site unless you're actually doing serious threat analysis against it. Because let's face it, last month you were building a call center, and that basically involved handling lots of minimum wage employees to read scripts off a computer screen, and now they're running chat software? Mm-hmm. Really? You're going to trust that? That's nuts. That's nuts. So I think you're going to see a lot more of this now that chatbots or chat software has been proven to be weak. So I think you're going to see it's going to be like dropping hand grenades in a barrel of fish. It's going to be just, you know, woohoo, let's try that. Let's see if we can find something. I reckon it's going to be a bad couple of months for people who do chat software.
And that's not the only story. Retailers Saks Fifth Avenue and Lord & Taylor's, they are high-end retailers here in the U.S. They also had card data stolen. Attackers who breached the retailers claim to have stolen upwards of 5 million accounts, but that number hasn't yet been confirmed.
Yeah, this one is a straight-up breach through a third party. So that is, they said that they had some third party associated with the network and they pivoted in through that to then escalate up to find the data that they wanted to extract. So it's the old story. Whoever connects to your network is operating at the same level of trust as you. Don't connect and then figure you'll fix it later. And we've heard that story plenty of times already this year.
What's also troubling is the Washington Post, in reporting on the story, quotes a security advisor, I guess, who has some knowledge of the case, saying that the intruders were in Saks and Lord & Taylor's networks for a year. Just hanging out, watching packets go by.
Yes. Well, this was, we actually recorded a podcast this week with some Cisco resellers talking about GDPR, the European, and what they're doing in terms of security. And one of the most scariest things about GDPR is that if you are breached, you have an obligation to report. As soon as you discover the breach, you must report it to the EU government within 3 days.
3 days?
3 days.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So once you discover the breach, you have to report to the government within 3 days, and you have to report where the breach happened and what was stolen and how it happened. And you have to, you have 3 days to deliver that in.
And you know that's tough because you're going to make that initial report and you're going to keep doing your investigation and find out, oh, they got more. Oh, they were over here. So we have to report again. Oh.
So if you end up, so the thing is that, you know, like Equifax and Facebook. So we've seen Facebook this week go from, oh, 5 million people. Oh, no, it was 25 million. Oh, it's 50 million. And then today it's probably more like 70 million. And they're now talking maybe they just got the lot. So like it might actually be like 150 million or more.
That's slow trickle.
Or even as many as just like 2 billion, just like everything. At some point or another, basically, you got everybody. I suspect that Facebook is, you know, so that's not going to be permitted under GDPR. And if you have to report to the EU for any EU citizen about where the breach is, you're also, it's going to have impacts to come to same businesses in the States and everywhere, I think, because everybody's got European customers. It's either that or don't do business in Europe. So you won't be able to get away with this sort of like been in my, up in my grills for a year and then come out and say, oh, we think it was 25,000. And then 3 weeks later say, oh, it was more than that.
Based on how well corporations do are protecting data, there may be a market here for like some kind of ignorance as a service offering where we just don't know. We can't tell. We have no idea if anything's happening. And so we don't have to report it.
Yeah. Well, that Equifax tried that.
It didn't work out so well, but eventually they
doubled down.
Right. In the end, it probably will backfire, but then you just, you know, that's why you have insurance.
Did you see the Panera Bread one? Panera Bread had systems that were just leaking data. When you went to Panera Bread, if you were registered as a customer there and you'd log in and then they'd put your customer ID. And then if you incremented the customer ID by one, you'd get somebody else's data.
Awesome.
So then they fixed it. And what they did was they just put it all behind an authentication, right? Mm-hmm. But once you authenticated, anybody can sign up for an account. Once you're authenticated, then you can just keep incrementing the number and stealing all the. And it was like people's addresses, names, last 4 digits of the credit card, all of that stuff. Turns out the guy in charge of Panera Bread is the 2013 chief information security officer of Equifax, who's on the record as saying, you can have too much security. So if you're watching, if you've been following in the news, have a follow Brian Krebs. He's to make things worse, when he sort of raised the case and suggested that they do something about it, they must have said something offensive to him, because now he's like up and he's going after
them. Oh, you don't want Brian on your case.
You don't want Krebs up in your grill. And so I'm expecting some more interesting stuff from him around the Panera Bread. He published his first post on the 2nd of April. And I suspect there's going to be much more, because he tweeted something the other day. He said, someone's given me a hint. I'm going into a Panera Bread to check it out in person. I'm expecting to hear, like, you know, the in-house Wi-Fi connects directly to the corporate network or something really egregious.
I'm bringing a few friends.
That's right. It just seems like, you know, you do not want to make, you know, Krebs is a bit, not that he's vindictive, but if you don't listen carefully and pay attention and just, you know, act in a certain way, you are going to get, you're going to have a very bad day.
I mean, here's the thing. People who are trying to tell you you have a security problem, they aren't the people to turn on, right? That's the wrong move, because you should fix the problem.
No, and especially when he stands on a soapbox the size that Krebs got.
Right, exactly.
He has the guy, and people are feeding him information. You don't want to take him on. He's bigger than you, Panera Bread. Just suck it up and eat, you know, and bite your tongue. Just get on with fixing these things. Right. But apparently, every time they do a fix, they turn around and brag about it. Oh, we totally sorted this out. And he goes like, no. Somebody pops up and goes, too easy. It's getting a bit amusing now.
Good Lord.
So if you're a Panera Bread customer loyalty account, make sure that password you are using is not in use anymore. Don't have it used anywhere else.
All right, on that fantastic news, this wraps up our news section for today's show. Please do stay tuned for a Coffee Talk conversation. We're talking with Kentik, Avi Friedman.
Kentik, he's one of our great CEO friends.
And founder. He is a dyed-in-the-wool nerd, so it's going to be a good conversation.
As Avi says, he says, you are one of us. So he's one of us, people. So stay on and listen to him. He's got good things to say.
That's right, and that's coming right up. Welcome to Coffee Talk, a short sponsored conversation to bring you up to speed on new ideas and technologies in about the time it takes for a good coffee break. Our guest today is Avi Friedman. He is co-founder and CEO at Kentik, and Kentik is sponsoring today's Coffee Talk. We're going to discuss combining network and business data for fun and packets. Avi, welcome back to Packet Pushers. One topic that's been coming up lately is the importance of monitoring and visibility. So I'm going to start by asking, what is it operators are looking for in all this data that they collect?
Operators that we work with are looking to understand, what is the truth? What is the meaning? What is the impact of packets in
truth?
They know there's gold in that network somehow.
Right, but they don't want to be looking at just, you know, streams of IP addresses and ports and protocols and going, what's going on? Users being affected. How can I save money? How can I make money? Basically, how can I do my fun router pontificating and not have everyone on my back because things are broken, or even things aren't broken, but they think they are.
Right. So to remind the audience, Kentik is about analyzing traffic flows using, you know, loosely what we could summarize as big data or machine learning approaches, and looking for patterns inside of the traffic flows that mean something at a business level. So in that sense, you might leap to the jump of intent. You're getting insight, getting business intent out of the data flows going through the network. So why is it? Now, the way that Kentik works is it takes IP flow data and analyzes that. Why is it that IP addresses and flow data just not enough? Why can't you just look at your network data to get the insight that you need?
You know, there's occasionally the wizard in the corner that knows every node, every customer, everything. But generally, people are running now where they've got applications. Often they're dynamically provisioned and expanded. People are using Kubernetes. They have customers. If you go beyond your mom and pop ISP, you've got, you know, everyone logging in and out. You've got applications. There's revenue tied to them. There are applications. And no one wants to look it up in multiple systems. And really to look at, is this something worth paging me for? It can be difficult. Even if I know there's 10 megabits of traffic or 100 megabits of traffic that's suffering from bad performance going to 5 countries, is that an attack? Is it actual traffic? Is it an application I care about? So just looking at the flow by itself can be useful for peering analytics. Sometimes you can just look at it and say, oh my God, that's a DDoS. Someone must have pissed someone off. But if you really want to have the insight, we'll take two words, insight to the, you know, to whether the network is operating according to my intent. Well, that's more than just the links. It's the applications going over on it and who are the users, you know.
So we're getting past the stage where you can do a quick packet capture, look at it and go, oh, I see what's happening, because we've gone from 10 meg internet connections to 10 gig internet connections, and how much data is coming down there. You can't make a reasonable packet capture. And even if you're getting flow data, you can't analyze it at that level of detail. So as things scale up, my view is that visibility and analytics just goes beyond what you can achieve yourself. You need a substantial platform like Kentek.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's got their, I'm allergic to languages where white space is syntax, so I don't use Python, but, I'm old, I use Perl. But Python, Go, Perl, whatever, everyone's got their things. So you can take a packet capture and then you can look it up in your, IPAM, and you can look it up in your, orchestration system, but that just doesn't scale, as you said, to today's volume.
What about metadata? Increasingly, we're seeing you can combine the actual network data with metadata from external sources, so GeoIPs, for example. How are you looking at that?
So we have two kinds of metadata that we see people really wanting to use. One of them is sort of the base technical data, like, again, GeoIP. We actually, threat databases, IP reputation, things like that. But and I would say one more, DNS, right? If you want to look at not just the packets and the flow, but correlate it with what was the user intending to do, right? To go back to intent, what site were they going to? What CDN was it on, right? Because CDNs are these wonderful magic packet transporters. Big service providers don't control, but they really want to understand what people are doing. So that's one set of it. The other is your orchestration systems. And I would say even across the enterprise, not just service providers, not just web companies, we're seeing people actually have systems of record for the things that are changing every potentially microsecond of what applications are provisioned, what the servers are, what the Docker IDs are, what the users are. So it's really those orchestration systems that we want to, people use our APIs and just set up, streams to, like R2D2 doc. And then when you're actually looking at traffic, you could look at it by application, by cloud infrastructure, by user, things like that. So not just the routers.
Well, I want to drill into something here because this is the metadata that you're bringing me, but you now have a feature called custom dimensions. And if I read the instructions right, the documentation right, what you're saying is I can actually put my own metadata on the flow records that I'm exporting to Kentek.
Absolutely. You can do it one of two ways. One, you can use our APIs and just go in and say, what custom dimensions do I want? And give us populators, which are BGP communities, IP addresses, any of the flow templates or things we augment. So you can say customer, whatever, but you don't have to tell us, ask us, you just do it, set it up yourself. Or the other way, we actually have a library that you can use. So you can set up the dimensions and basically do your own unification and export, more of a web company thing. But, if you've got your own Kafka stream and you've already done some streaming joins with Spark or whatever, and then you want to put that in, then we have a library so people can do that too.
So try and think about that from an operator perspective. Maybe what I want to do is say this /24 belongs to customer X. So when I export those flow records to Kentek, I'm going to put a piece of metadata and say customer X's data, and then I can do a search on that later on in the Kentek dashboard. Is that
right? Yep. Well, yeah, it could be a set of 24s. It could be that you actually have an application that at this point in time is using 400/32s. And then you want to be provisioning that via the API every time you turn up. First of all, every time you turn something on or off programmatically, you should be monitoring. And I would say probably 25%, when we talk to people out in the world, actually do that. But that's number one. And then you can look at it later by saying, show me everything for this application, not just have to go get those IP addresses together. And that's all you can just do that on your own, although we preset insight anomaly detection dashboards. So if you're going to do customer, we suggest you a column name. If you're going to do application, we suggest you, but you don't have to. You can do it however you want.
But this is the thing, is that you're actually saying this is programmatic. So I would have an on-prem, some sort of OSS operational system, whatever. And I could now say, I could program the Kentek API so that I say that whenever I see this, I can say that's customer X. So then my help desk can go into the Kentek interface, click a button and say, show me what's happening with customer X. And all of a sudden, all the flow records are filtered down to that customer. But you might have hundreds or thousands of customers. So you can still get those dimensions and those custom dimensions.
Yeah, we have some very large ISPs where we actually have done some code which might make its way to GitHub, where we watch their DHCP stream, build, you know, using our API, a routing table of up to, it's a very large ISP, you know, 3 million simultaneous users logged in, custom dimension. Similarly, doing 400,000 DNS queries a second. And we're building a routing table of who queried what and associating it with the flow so that they can look at, people want to look at not just was it Akamai, was it Netflix, and even to see Akamai, well, they're in, you know, I used to run that network, that virtual network, and they're in 1,000 AFSs. But also what site? They want to see, is it Apple Downloads or iTunes or whatever? And so DNS as well. So, you know, if people don't have those connectors built in, don't have their own streams, then you can actually, you know, just tap your streams to DNS data, and we can do that heavy lifting too.
So how are you tying all this information, this data gathering, back to business value? Like, what is the sort of top line benefit that I'm getting as a customer?
So the top line is being able to only spend time on things that matter to the business, however you define that. Mm-hmm. Right. So we have ad tech companies, and they program in a revenue estimate with every flow, right? Is this an exchange that all the revenue goes through? Is this one of my highest valued customers? And it may sound cynical, and it is cynical, but there we have probably 20 customers that will only get paged at night if it's something that affects over a certain revenue threshold. Mm-hmm. And being able to see that, being able to know that, we have people that in the NOC, you know, similarly want to tie all that together, or it's an application that they just consider to be critical. Being able to see that, and not just by port and protocol. You know, flow tools for, you know, 20 years have said, oh, it's port 80, so it's a web thing, which isn't always necessarily true, but which web thing, right? And,
this is where the metadata
does this matter? Is this some dev test thing that doesn't matter, or is this, you know, a critical thing that's my gateway to Twilio, without which no one can sign up for any of my other applications? So it's really taking it out of just bits and, you know, the IP addresses and even ASs, and taking it to what it means to me in the service provider space. It is, how much does this customer cost? You know, we have some of our customers in their press releases about using Kentek who said, this enables our salespeople, which you wouldn't think salespeople would be going in and, you know, looking at traffic data, but, well, they want to know who are they sending traffic to for free, that's peering, and then that would be profitable. So there's even sort of revenue component to it, not to enterprise, but to the service provider side.
So we've talked about this in the context of operators, Avi. I guess this would equally apply to enterprise, and particularly from the terms of the security function, because you could start to tag flows as high risk or low risk. What you've just told me about a carrier backbone who only wants to hear when the top 10, top 20 customers have a problem, you could do the same sort of concept for enterprise when you're watching your internet connections?
Oh, absolutely. We have some people that track their executives and make sure they have a great experience. And
I don't recommend that. I've always recommended that you track your executives and you give them the least experience, because that way you get more money to fund an upgrade.
Well, that is one way to do it as well.
Speaking of cynical.
Remind me not to work for packet pushers as an executive. So, well, I think, you know, there's the people that that are the, you know, clickety-clickety nerd knob, you know, switchers, and there's the even higher level executive. And, you know, in the security space, absolutely. We integrate some IP reputation data, working with Spam House, who's very, you know, carrier-centric, but also works in the enterprise. We let people bring their own if they have their own whole SOC and whatever. And then it's a case of, you know, yes, they can go look at, in some cases, specific users. Typically we don't know the actual name. It's more like a hash. If you look at GDPR-ish type concerns, we don't want to know someone's actual name. But, you know, and then do it. In the enterprise, it's, you know, if you look at a typical large financial institution, you know, we see them having between 1 and 8,000, maybe 10,000 applications. And they're actually getting very sophisticated about the recent applications they build that are internal. More of them are internal, and more of them are, you know, sort of cloudily deployed. But people want to ask the question, what percentage, like, let's say I've decided I'm going to go to OpenStack and AWS. Well, what percentage of the applications running on the network are not provisioned that way? Tell me what my, you know, KPI, for lack of a better buzzword, is on my, well, for lack of a better buzzword, digital transformation. And that's actually, you know, you may laugh, but that's actually meaningful to people because they're trying to do things to get governance, to get everything under control. And, you know, if you have an orchestration system, now all of a sudden, and you plug that into traffic data, now you can see the traffic data that is something you're aware of. And then you can just subtract that and then focus in on the things that are, you know, rogue, innovative. Mm. They mean the same thing to different people, you know, in your infrastructure. So there's a lot of different use cases.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of Coffee Talk. Avi, how can folks follow you on social if you're social? And if they're interested in looking and learning more about Kentik, what can they do?
Sure. So our website is kentik.com, K-E-N-T-I-K.com. We've got a bunch of videos, our whole knowledge base accessible. I'm Avi Friedman on Twitter, LinkedIn. If you are interested in getting a demo, any of the Packet Pushers folks, just let people know. And I'm happy to join, give you a special CEO nerd demo. Love to engage with fellow network folks.
You may be one of the nerdiest CEOs we've talked to, I think. That's a compliment.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I can guarantee that. That is a fact.
All right. Well, thanks, Avi and Kentik, for sponsoring today's episode. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.